Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. Before we start today's episode, we just want to mention that we recently launched a new YouTube channel called Paranormally Listed. On that channel, we examine unexplained phenomena. For example, we have videos about killers who were haunted by the ghosts of their victims, monsters who may have killed people, and alleged UFO crashes that predate the Roswell incident. In the next few weeks, we plan on releasing 2 videos a week, so you should check it out. You can find it at youtube.com/paranormallylisted. And now, for our first case, we're going back to June 1984. On June 6, 1984, the video game Tetris was released in the Soviet Union. It was created by software engineer Alexei Pajitnov, and it was available on the Electronica 60, which was a computer sold in the Soviet Union. Tetris has gone on to be one of the best-selling video games of all time. On June 8th, an F-5 tornado touched down in the town of Barneveld, Wisconsin. The town was nearly destroyed. 9 people were killed, 200 were injured, and there was $25 million in damage. In June 1984, 15-year-old Risa Trexler lived in Salisbury, North Carolina. Salisbury is about 43 miles north of Charlotte, North Carolina. In the 1980s, it had a population of around 22,000 people. It was the headquarters of the grocery store chain Food Lion. On June 15, 1984, Risa had 2 male friends over at her house. Risa's sister, 13-year-old Jody, was also there. It was the first week of summer vacation. Risa and her friends were watching MTV. At around 3:30 p.m., Risa's friends left, and she was home alone with her sister, Jody. At some point, Jody realized that Risa wasn't in the house. She thought that Risa might have gone over to her grandparents' home, which was next door. Jody went outside and saw that her grandparents' doors were closed and their cars weren't in the driveway. Jody assumed that Risa had run an errand with her grandparents. A short time later, Risa's grandfather returned home. He ran out of his house screaming, and Jody heard him. She rushed over to the house. One of the spare bedrooms was splattered with blood. On the floor was the new dead body of 15-year-old Risa Trexler. When the police arrived, they examined the body. They found semen on her right thigh. The medical examiner found more semen inside of her. Risa had been stabbed 18 times in the upper chest and the neck. One stab wound severed her spinal cord. The blade of the knife had broken off and it was still embedded in her right shoulder. The police couldn't find any evidence of a break-in or forced entry. They also couldn't find any fingerprints that didn't belong to the family. They did find a strand of hair, but it didn't have a root. While DNA technology wouldn't come to the United States for a few more years, rootless hair was useless for DNA testing when it was available. The process for getting DNA from rootless hair wasn't discovered until 2018. The police started off by questioning the last people who saw Risa. They were the friends who were at the house that afternoon and her sister Jody. Initially, they thought that the killer was a man, so they focused on the 2 male friends that were watching MTV with her. But the police could connect them to the murder. However, they never found any evidence that cleared them either. So they remained suspects. 4 days after the murder, Risa's funeral was held. Thousands of people showed up. What many people thought was odd was the way Jody behaved. They thought she seemed awfully composed for a 13-year-old girl whose 15-year-old sister had been stabbed to death. In the weeks after the murder, the police didn't find any viable suspects. It was not long before the case went cold. This only led to speculation amongst the townspeople, and rumors swirled. One of the leading theories was that Risa's grandfather came home and found her having sex with someone. He snapped and killed her. Another rumor was that Jody killed her. People thought this because Jody was one of the last people to see Risa alive. Jody said she was home alone when the murder was committed, and this was a terrible alibi. No one could confirm it, and she was right next door to the crime scene. They argued she could have killed her sister and then returned home and washed up. The townspeople also thought that Jody's behavior at the funeral was odd. Eventually, these rumors reached the police. Jody quickly shot to the top of the suspect list. But there were several problems with the theory that Jody killed her sister. The first is that Jody had no cuts or marks on her that indicated she was involved in the brutal stabbing murder. Another problem is, where did the semen come from? Third, Jody had no motive to kill her older sister. The police theorized that Jody may not have worked alone and worked with a man in the murder, which would explain the source of the semen. The police put a lot of pressure on Jody's family. It got to be so bad that Risa and Jody's mother even began to wonder if Jody had killed Risa. Jody was adamant that she was innocent. She continued to live in Salisbury, where most people believed that she had killed her sister. Things only got worse when social media became prominent. People would make postings about the murder. They even started groups that promoted the idea that Jody was the killer. Then one day in the late 2010s, Jody was watching TV and the Dr. Phil show came on. On the show, the host, Phil McGraw, was announcing the results of polygraph exams. So Jody decided to write to the show and she explained her situation. To her surprise, the show's producers contacted her and asked her to be a guest on the show. On the show, she was confronted by a woman named Laura. Laura's last name was not given. Laura lived down the road from Risa and Jody Trexler. She was also the daughter of the man who was police captain at the time. Although there was no physical evidence that Jody committed the murder, Laura was convinced she was the killer. She thought of Jody as the black sheep of the family who was jealous of her older sister. Laura said that one day on the school bus before the murder, she heard Jody say she hated Risa and wished she was dead. Laura said she thought it was odd that Jody didn't show any emotion at the funeral. Jody had explained in the past that just because she didn't have an emotional breakdown in public in front of strangers didn't mean she wasn't deeply upset by the tragic loss of her sister. Laura said that growing up, she heard rumors that Jody was the killer. She made it clear that her father, the police captain, never shared any information about the investigation with her. Laura claimed she never really had an opinion about Jody's involvement in the murder of her sister until about 2013, about 29 years after the murder. Laura said she thought it was odd that Jody was more concerned with clearing her name than finding out who killed her sister. Then Laura said she had a dream where Risa appeared to her. In the dream, Risa told her to find out who killed her. Risa was holding a heart, and in the heart was a photo of Jody. Laura said that there were two ways she could look at the dream. Either Risa was saying she loved her sister, or Risa knew in her heart that Jody was the one who killed her. Laura also thought that Jody knew things about the murder that were never made public. She also thought that it was strange that Jody was so close to the murder, yet she didn't hear anything. But she did hear her grandfather screaming when he fled from the crime scene. So the Dr. Phil producers had both Jody and Laura on the show. With no evidence, Laura confronted Jody and accused her of killing Risa. Jody mostly glared at Laura, and the host of Dr. Phil McGraw, picked apart Laura's arguments. He pointed out that her jumps in logic were gigantic. For example, the fact that Jody was considered a black sheep did not make her a murderer. He also pointed out that people grieve in different ways. Just because Jody didn't grieve the same way that Laura might have does not mean that Jody stabbed her sister to death. Laura also said that the house where Jody and Risa lived was about 10 feet away from their grandparents' house, but they were actually 300 feet apart. Also, just because Risa was attacked does not mean she could have screamed. For example, the killer might have covered her mouth or threatened her if she were to scream. Risa was also stabbed in the neck multiple times. Being stabbed in the neck would make it difficult to scream. So it was quite possible that Jody didn't hear anything when her sister was being murdered. Then McGraw read the results of the polygraph exam. Jody was telling the truth when she said she didn't kill her sister and didn't know who committed the murder. The episode featuring Jody aired in April 2018. Jody's appearance on the Dr. Phil show put Reese's murder in the national spotlight. So the case was reopened by the police in Salisbury. The detective who took on the case grew up in Salisbury, but he was only 6 when the murder was committed, so he didn't remember it. The detective looked at the evidence, and it turned out that the forensic evidence, like the semen, had been well preserved. The crime lab was able to create a DNA profile, but they didn't have a match to the DNA. So the DNA profile was sent to Parabon Nano Labs for genetic genealogy. Parabon Nano Labs is most famous for discovering that Joseph James DeAngelo was the infamous serial killer known as the Golden State Killer. In April 2019, 35 years after Risa Trexler's murder, Parabon Nano Labs matched the DNA to a man named Curtis Edward Blair. Jody, her family, and her friends had never heard of Blair. He had no connection to them. It was a stranger-on-stranger crime. At the time, Blair was 40 years old, and he was working at the Frito-Lay's factory that was about a block away from the crime scene. Sometime after the murder, he moved to California. He had also lived in New York at some point. He had several arrests for crimes like attempted robbery and assault with a deadly weapon. When Parabon Nano Labs linked him to Risa's murder, the police had no idea where he was. So the cold case investigator began to look for him. It turned out that Curtis Blair would never face justice for the murder of Risa. He died in 2004 in San Diego, California, around the age of 60, from heart failure. After his death, his body was transported back to Salisbury, where he was buried. His body was exhumed and a sample of his DNA was taken. It was confirmed that his DNA was the DNA found at the crime scene. Jody, her family, and the cold case detective thought it was disappointing that he had already died because they wanted him to know they had caught him. They also wanted him to go to prison. After the DNA match was made, the cold case detective publicly stated that Jody was completely exonerated of the murder of her sister. For our second case, we're traveling back to December 1992. George H.W. Bush was president of the United States. It would be his last full month in office because in November 1992, he lost the election to Bill Clinton. On December 9th, Prince Charles and Princess Diana announced that they had separated after 15 years of marriage. On Christmas week, the number one movie was the military drama A Few Good Men, which is based on the stage play penned by Aaron Sorkin. The number one song was the mega smash hit I Will Always Love You, performed by Whitney Houston, which appeared on the Bodyguard soundtrack. The song, which was originally written and recorded by country legend Dolly Parton, eventually spent 14 weeks at the number one spot, which set a new record. In December 1992, 25-year-old Christy Morak lived with a roommate in a townhouse in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She was a sixth grade teacher at a local elementary school. According to her family, it was a dream job. She had grown up in the small city of Shamokin in Pennsylvania's coal region. After high school, she attended Millerville University in Millersville, Pennsylvania. She planned on spending Christmas with her family in Shamokin when school went on Christmas break. On Monday, December 21st, Merak didn't show up for school. The school's principal tried to contact her, but she didn't answer her phone. After 5 phone calls, he became concerned, so he drove over to her townhouse. He found her car parked outside. It was covered in ice. He went to the front door and found it slightly ajar. He knew that something was wrong. He walked into the townhouse, calling out her name. On the living room floor, he found the dead body of 25-year-old Christy Merak. Her face had been beaten beyond recognition. She was wearing her coat and gloves as if she was getting ready to leave for the day. The principal went to a neighbor's and called the police. The police did their best piecing together what happened that morning. Merak's roommate left at around 7 a.m. and Merak usually left at around 7:45. Just before she went to clean off her car, the killer came to her front door. There were no signs of a break-in or first entry, so they believe that Merak let the killer inside. This led to speculation that Merak knew her killer. Something happened, and Merak tried to defend herself using a wooden cutting board. Instead, the killer used the cutting board to beat her face. The cutting board was found next to her body. The killer also strangled her with his hands and her sweater. Merak was also raped. The police found the killer's DNA on Merak and on the floor. Since the police believe that Merak knew her killer, they started investigating the men in her life. They quickly eliminated the principal as her killer. One problem was that Merak kept her life private from her family, so they didn't know if she was dating anyone. It turned out that she did have a secret boyfriend. He was 20 years older than her, and he was married. But the police were able to clear him as a suspect. By April 1993, the police had conducted interviews with over 500 people and cleared 40 persons of interest. But no arrests were made in the case. The murder was hard on the Merak family. By Easter 1993, they still had the Christmas tree up and her presents were under it, still wrapped. Years went by and no developments were made in the case. 15 years after the murder, in 2007, Merak's brother paid for a billboard next to a highway in Lancaster. Some tips came in, but the billboard did not lead to an arrest. In 2015, the case was reopened. The killer's DNA had been saved, and it was sent to the crime lab. In 2017, a member of the district attorney's office was at a conference, and they saw a presentation given by a representative from Parabon Nanolabs. The representative talked about a technology that could generate composite images based on a DNA profile. The district attorney's office sent the DNA profile to Parabon Nanolabs. In 2017, the composite image was released. But once again, no leads were generated. After Joseph James D'Angelo was arrested in April 2018, thanks to Parabon Nanolabs, Merak's brother asked the district attorney's office if genetic genealogy could be used to identify his sister's killer. In turn, the district attorney's office asked Parabon Nanolabs if they could do it. They agreed and partnered with renowned genetic genealogist C.C. Moore. Moore had taught herself the process of genetic genealogy, which she had used to help adopted children find their birth parents. They traced the DNA from Merak's crime scene to a 49-year-old man named Raymond Charles Rowe. At the time of the murder, Rowe was 24 years old and he was engaged to be married. Rowe lived in Lancaster County, and he was well known in the community. He was a popular wedding DJ who worked under the name DJ Freeze. He first became prominent in the community in his teens for his breakdancing abilities. In the 1990s, he was the house DJ at the Chameleon Club, a popular nightclub in Lancaster. He eventually transitioned to DJing weddings and school dances. Investigators trailed him to a school dance and collected some gum he spat out and a water bottle he drank from. It was compared to the DNA left at the crime scene. It was a match. On June 25, 2018, 25 and a half years after Christy Murak's murder, Raymond Rowe was arrested. When he was arrested, he was living with his fourth wife and she had a daughter. The police did not reveal if Rowe and Murak knew each other. However, a complimentary pass to the Chameleon Club, where Rowe DJed, was found in her purse. The police said Rowe had not been considered a suspect until his DNA was linked to the crime scene. In January 2019, 50-year-old Raymond Rowe pleaded guilty to rape and murder. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. But then, in August 2021, Rowe asked to withdraw his guilty plea. Rowe claimed that after he was arrested, he was held in isolation without any clothes, and he was only given a blanket. He was constantly sick, and he lost 25 pounds. Rowe said he didn't have much communication with his lawyers, and when he did talk to them, they encouraged him to plead guilty because the prosecution had DNA evidence. They also said he might be given the death penalty if he went to trial and were convicted. So he felt like he had no choice but to plead guilty. But he claimed he was innocent. He said they had met Murak a few months before the murder. She had come up to him while he was DJing. After their initial meeting, they started a casual sexual relationship, but they kept it a secret because they were both in relationships. They had sex once in his car and twice at her home when no one else was there. Rowe said that he went over to her home on the morning of December 21st and they had consensual sex. When he left, she was still alive. At the time, he worked for ServiceMaster, a carpet cleaning company. He worked all day and found out about the murder on the evening news. The judge has yet to rule if Rowe can withdraw his plea. If he can withdraw it, he will go to trial for the murder. By the time of this recording, 53-year-old Raymond Rowe is serving his life sentence for rape and murder at SCI Waymart in Waymart, Pennsylvania. Both the police and the district attorney's office consider the case closed. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Our producer, fact checker, and sound designer was Anel Cloutier. Please don't forget to check out our new YouTube channel, Paranormally Listed. You can find it at youtube.com/paranormallylisted. Of course, we still have our original true crime channel, Criminally Listed. We have over 325 videos featuring bizarre but true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. But that's all for today. Thanks again for listening. Please take care of yourself and stay safe.